Good evening. This evening we begin the fourth year of our course and our experiment on looking at the relationship between the White House and the press. We had 2 years of White House communications operations. Last year we looked at the president, the press, and democratic society. And this year we're looking at the White House press corps and its relationship with the president. And some of the same kinds of issues come up, such as the relationship of the press to the health of our democracy. And so today we have a correspondent who can tell us a lot about how things have changed over time, because she has been at the White House since the 1970s, which I have to admit I have too, watching reporters do their work. And Anne has been an important part of television coverage of the president since the Ford administration, and she will be the incoming president of the White House Correspondents Association. So, welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
And can we start off with your talking about how you do your work? Take us through your day.
Martha, this is a little difficult to be under the microscope. It is usually our job to put those guys at the White House under a microscope. So if I talk too long or get too long-winded, give me a kick, because that's what we do to members of the White House staff who brief us too long and too long-winded. We like nice, quick sound bites. Imagine being a college junior, liberal arts college in Roanoke, Virginia, Hollins College, all women, and I had no earthly idea what I wanted to do professionally. But Hollins started a program my junior year where the month of January was an independent study. One whole month to do one course, one issue, nothing else, no other distractions. I went to work as an intern and did a paper on the local CBS affiliate in Roanoke, Virginia, which is a giant station. Covers the entire western part of the state. And I saw everything from the live Dr. Pepper commercials they did in the morning, live country music show, highest per capita consumption of Dr. Pepper of any city in the country, to how they edited the late night movies that were on the air. CBS was the powerhouse news organization nationally at that point. Walter Cronkite was the one everyone sat down and turned to. And I got really interested in the room down at the end of the hallway, because there was a very hot governor's race going that year. As it turned out, the first Republican since Reconstruction was elected governor in the Commonwealth of Virginia, up against a very solid Democratic political machine. Now, I took some politics, some economics, some sociology, some history, a lot of psychology, some sciences, no math, and I knew I had a decent general liberal arts background, but there was no journalism, no communications at Hollins College at that time, and this one month-long mini-semester convinced me that this was just about the neatest thing I'd ever come, and the tools I needed were the things I already had. I had the sociology. I had a lot of psychology. I had the kind of literature, art and music courses that I have always told my kids that if you don't have that kind of education, you can still go out into the world an ignorant person if you don't know the difference between Brahms and Beethoven or have never read the great literature of the world. So when I graduated from Hollins College in 1969, the local station surprised me, called me, and offered me a job as the Cub political reporter for the station. At that moment, the ink began to run through my veins. So I have no formal journalism training, and I like to say that I learned the way Eric Severide said many journalists of that era did when they made the move, particularly from distinguished World War II newspaper careers into the burgeoning television news area, and they learned at the expense of the public, he used to say. I worked at the local TV station with this very new experience of a brand new governor, came from the town where I was the reporter. They actually moved me to Richmond to cover the state legislature. I loved politics. I loved finding stories, searching for things, putting pieces together, and then being able to polish it with a script and get it on the air. Mm-hmm. And I loved being a big fish in a very little pond. And then one day ABC News called. Now, I know the reason I got the first job was because the There were very few women on the air back then, and I'm sure that's why ABC called me as well, because all the networks were looking for women. Fast forward, 5 years after I graduated from college, I walk up the White House driveway as the first woman assigned by a network to cover the White House. The days at the White House, what I love about them is you never know how they're going to begin, and you never know where they are going to end. Just as an example, 1:40 in the morning, I am sound asleep, and the phone rings. It's in our news desk saying, an airplane has just hit the White House. Well, I imagine a jetliner. Mm-hmm. But it was only a small little private aircraft, but whenever anybody intrudes into that White House space, much less hit the White House. Mm-hmm. So I jumped out of bed and I drove down to the White House. The streets are empty, and of course the gates are all in a lockdown, but cell phones were brand new. In fact, I didn't have an ABC when I had my own. And I stood out in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, and on television, in our overnight newscast, in our Good Morning America early morning newscast, I could dictate, I could talk on the air, and then they would use their stationary cameras to show. And indeed, a small plane flown by an absolute crazy man not only hit the White House, but hit just below the president's bedroom window. Mm-hmm. I knew, having covered the White House that long, how significant this had become. The television truck finally came around, and so for the Good Morning America newscasts, I actually had a camera and a satellite truck. In fact, I stood on top of the truck as we looked up the south lawn. But again, I had this cell phone with me. Now, it was my own personal one. Nobody had the number except my four children, who were all in grade school. And just before we hit the 8 o'clock news, I could hear Charlie Gibson in my ear getting ready to introduce me. The cell phone in my lap went off. Now, I knew it wasn't the control room because I had a little earpiece. They could have talked to me that way. I pick it up. It's my fourth grade son who said, Mom, I threw up in carpool on the way to school. She's dropped me back. Mom dropped me back home. It's okay. I'm in your bed. You know, a reporter has to do just about everything at once. That day went very, very late. The fellow did not survive the crash. It was a wonderful political and human interest story for the rest of the day. So with covering the White House, you never know what you're going to get, how early it's going to start, how long it's going to go, or what impact it's going to have beyond. And maybe later I could talk about September 11th and what a devastating day that was for the White House. But basically, as a White House reporter, you have to be able to catch whatever they pitch first thing in the morning and then play it all day, making sure you get as much mileage as you can out of the potential story that that seems to unfold in that particular day.
In your ideas about your reporting and what it is you want to do, do you have an idea of a person that you're trying to get to? Like sometimes, you know, people say, well, you know, the Buffalo Milkman, that used to be one. And another is, you know, will my mother understand it? And would she be interested in it?
I've never focused stories on, gee, what would my aunt in Miami want to know?
Right.
Or what would a classroom of seventh graders want to know? It's usually what I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes every television journalist, everyone who stands in front of a camera knows who we have to please. It's not the White House. It's not our mothers. It's our executive producer who is sitting in a control room watching the feeds come in. And especially when I'm on live, I have the response. I don't have anyone there as a gatekeeper saying, oh, wait, don't say that, or oh, don't say this, or don't use that word. But if you do use the wrong words or do take the wrong approach on the story, you won't be there the next night during the story. So I'm trying to please my executive producer.
Have their ideas of what constitutes news changed in that time
Very
period?
Very good question. When I first came to cover the White House, who made the agenda in Washington was different. It was a time, I came in Christmas of 1974, brand new president, Gerald Ford, Watergate was over, I didn't cover any of that. The agenda for the news was set by the major American daily newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today didn't exist. But if there was a major story on the front page of those newspapers, I can guarantee it would be on ABC News that night. So you'd come to work open the newspapers, look at the front page, and that would dictate kind of where the course of the day would go. Today, everything is carried live. We have 24-hour cable television networks. We have the internet, where news is constantly refreshed. I look at sites now, and I've quit looking at Politico, the news site, because it's all stuff I saw this morning. Where's the new stuff? You know, bring me something that's bringing new. So now the White House does not cater to the major morning newspapers and has the last event around 2 o'clock in the afternoon so the networks can all get the spots ready for the evening news. They cater all day long to the cable news talk channels so that the stories can get out there and get well enough, you know, hashed around, then get their points out early. So the agenda and what we go out to cover every day, I think, is very much dictated by how a story plays while it's live and who gets to you and who you can get to.
I noticed in the White House talks about using so many different different media, but I noticed in the Louis Libby trial and the exhibits that have come up and the talking points, Louis Libby was the chief of staff for Vice President Cheney. And in the Valerie Plame Joseph Wilson case, that in trying to figure out their responses to the op-ed piece that from July of 2003 by Joseph Wilson, a former ambassador, that the people on the list of the strategies, the was Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, David Sanger of the New York Times, Judith Miller of the New York Times, the national news magazines were talked about as one strategy, Tim Russert of Meet the Press, and that it really, when it came down to an issue that was a national issue, it really wasn't the local press.
And it was a more sophisticated angle. They were trying, the White House top level, not the press secretary who's out front, but those who are pulling the strings of policy, are looking for how to get their ideas into the heads of what they call the wise men, the talkers, the talking heads on Tim Russert's broadcast or ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, or even onto some of the talkers on Good Morning America, get it into a David Sanger front page column or analysis in the New York Times, and that's, or Robert Novak, a columnist whose agenda is very clear. And you get your ideas and your thoughts out there, and then the rest of the press corps, the more immediate beat reporters, breaking news reporters, begin to pick that up. It's the same reason, Martha, why on the day that the president gives the State of the Union address, President Bush doesn't call me and say, now, Ann, here's what I'm going to talk about tonight. Even though I'm the one standing on the White House lawn or sitting behind the ABC microphone, he calls up the anchors of the evening news and the anchors of the weekend talk shows. And those are the people whose coverage that night will shape everybody else's coverage. That's where the White House higher level communications effort is aimed.
And when they were in the Libby case, when they were aiming at the at elite newspapers and news magazines, they were doing pretty much what you talked about that was done earlier, that in an earlier time, they thought that that was going to drive, that, that Sanger's story would
but
drive
again,
how they were
covered. But again, that's because the nature of the story they were trying to get out was spin. It was nuance. It was putting a little English on the ball. Everybody was reporting the headline that that President Bush said Saddam Hussein was out after that nuclear material that was nicknamed Yellow Cake. Some people were reporting that an ambassador went over to Niger, couldn't find any trace, and then did a column in the op-ed page of the New York Times saying the administration was wrong. People could cover that. Why did he go? How did this happen? What does the administration want to put it that, you know, my fingerprints aren't on this, is what the administration wanted to say. And you can't really do that in 20-second sound bites on the evening news. You can do it in the larger context of the thinking print, more intellectual level of print journalism.
How has the gathering of information changed for you? In the time period that since the Ford administration,
the news gathering has not changed that much. At the White House, we have a very finite area where we can operate, as a reporter. You've seen the White House briefing room on the on the evening news or on the morning news or on West Wing, the TV program. And behind there, there are little cubby holes where the networks work, where newspaper reporters have smaller kind of desk-like areas, but not really conducive to doing private conversations. I spend my day from the morning when I walk in reading my email, reading the wires, reading electronically a lot of the newspapers. I must tell you, in the last 6 months, I very rarely have I picked up the newspaper. I just don't have the time. But I can get a lot of the newspaper headlines. ABC cuts clips and gives us little digests of them a couple of times a day so that I don't have to rifle through all the newspapers. And then I get on the telephone. It's still got to be the telephone. Sometimes you can email an aide. This morning, real quickly in line on, I asked them to please respond to something that Carl Levin, the senator, had said that the White House told the senators to block that resolution on Iraq. And basically got back a couple of emails saying, well, we've been talking to senators, not denying it. But basically you got to get these substance aides on the phone and talk to them and milk them a little bit. And that's just what we used to do in the olden days.
Right. But it seems that the reporting now from the White House involves more stories throughout the day. That the news cycle was a different cycle.
That's a good observation. I think many days that's the case. Not always. There is, the news is shorter, more compartmentalized. Maybe all of us have a little bit shorter attention span. It's true that at the White House, there's usually, for the networks at least, there are three White House correspondents. And that's been true throughout. You can't really cover a 24-hour day without three of us. But very often, my colleague Tom Gerrell or Sam Donaldson or Britt Hume would be working on one big main story, and then something else would come up, and I'd pick that up, and I would be working that story. It would be not unusual to have two White House spots on the evening news in a single night. Not so much anymore. Now we divvy it up a little bit more, and we can cover so much more outside of Washington that we don't have to rely on White House stand-ups as much as we did during the days when it was film, when there was less mobility, and when everything wasn't live. So technically, it wasn't as easy to cover around the country.
Is the does the president get about the same amount of coverage from one president to another?
Presidents get incredibly intensive coverage at the same times of their presidency, but not all presidencies are exactly equal. My favorite time to cover presidents is in the first hours of a brand new presidency, especially when it's one political party giving way to another, whether it's a Bill Clinton who has defeated a Republican George Bush, or whether it's a Governor George Bush who's been elected after Democrat Bill Clinton couldn't run again. Whenever you have that turnover of political power, you have a new agenda, you have a lot of new people, you have a great new amount of material out there, both people and issues out there. The other most intensive time to cover the president is a time of scandal. The first few months of Bill Clinton's second term was the Monica Lewinsky scandal. And that was as intensive as Iran-Contra, as I wasn't here for Watergate, but I'm sure. So presidents do go through periods of very intensive coverage. And then they go through political times when Bill Clinton once actually said, but I am relevant. The Republicans suddenly took hold of Capitol Hill, and everybody ran screaming up there. I remember after the Gerald Ford election in 76, I was one of the network anchors in New York on the set with Harry Reasoner and Howard K. Smith. And 8 o'clock at night, my editors decided Jimmy Carter was going to win, and they called me on the phone on their desk saying, tomorrow morning get to Plains, Georgia. The rest of the Ford administration didn't exist. We all simply decamped to Plains, Georgia, and the power and the focus of the presidency, in effect, moved there.
Would you say that was true at the end of the Clinton administration?
To some extent, it was. And why it won't be true at the end of the Bush administration. At a time of war, the commander-in-chief, there are three stories that trump everything else, one of which is Americans in combat. So long as a lame duck president has Americans fighting and dying in a foreign war, be it Vietnam, be it Korea, be it Iraq or Persian Gulf, that president is going to command daily, hourly minute-by-minute attention. Otherwise, yeah, Bill Clinton's agenda curtailed a little bit, and of course you get into a big political year, so most of us spent all of our time jumping back and forth between the Gore plane and the Bush plane.
Right. And you're going to have, this can be a new person coming in as somebody without any kind of experience.
But what's different about this year? Yeah. You probably already discussed it. First time in 75 years that there's not only not an incumbent, but there's no incumbent vice president running, which means the fields on both sides are very large and very unpredictable.
Yeah. And
they are unpredictable, aren't they?
Yeah.
I don't want it to all be decided before we have a good run at it.
And it's going to be certainly interesting. When you're doing your reporting, do you see yourself as a surrogate for the public?
Yes, very definitely. Uh-huh. Very definitely. And I'll give you an example of that. President Bush's very first news conference after he took office, he didn't have in those first couple of months. Right. He had one month today after the September 11th attacks.
Right. Yeah.
And he kept talking about how we all have to, you know, report things that we see. And if you see a crop duster in your backyard that, you know, doesn't belong there, report it to the authorities. And that morning on some radio phone calls, radio stations are allowed to call the ABC correspondents, ABC radio stations call ABC correspondents and chat with us during their morning talk radio time, and we get a huge audience on that. And so many had asked me that morning, what are we looking for? I mean, what are we supposed to report? And I happened to be the last person the president called on that night. And many of the headline-making news stories or questions have been asked. I said, Mr. President, what is it that you want us to look for? What Americans are saying, what is it we're supposed to read? And he said, well, if you look out your back door and there's a crop duster in your backyard and it's not yours, call the police. If you see somebody hanging around the nuclear power plant, call the authorities. The fact is nobody really knew what we were looking for, except for 19 hijackers that we didn't know to look for on the planes that day.
Yeah. Do you find that the White Houses over time have changed the way they've been dealing with reporters? Do you find the same kinds of issues in the relationship between the White House and the press?
The White House is a gigantic political machine. And basically, like any car is going to run like any other car. Now, a BMW is going to run a little smoother than a Geo Metro, but it's going to, it's going to basically, there's a steering wheel, there are four wheels, and there's a driver's seat, and some way to turn the thing on. The White House generally operates the same way with a press staff that's there to hand out the daily routine, press briefings that are held with regularity, a presidential staff that meets at 7 or 7:30 every morning for senior staff meetings to decide how are we going to, you know, what's out there, what are we doing today, let's all stay on message. Presidents have State of the Union addresses, they travel overseas to see foreign leaders, all of that, the way a foreign leader is welcomed to the White House, the protocol, the formulation, the machinery, the mechanics of the White House have been the same for the 30 years that you and I have been there.
Yeah.
What also doesn't change is that the layers of White House management all approach the press in different ways. The president can be magnanimous and gracious and give us all nicknames and call us by name at press conferences. The chief of staff can be gracious to the opinion leaders, the big-time columnists. The press secretary takes the flack every day. And the lower-level policy aides are the ones who not only know what's going on, they have time to tell you because they're not in all those big meetings. That structure is the same.
Uh-huh.
Do some administrations favor some media over other? Yeah, you walk into the White House now, every television screen is on Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
CNN isn't there. CNN is a pariah to many of those in the office. So there is a little bit of difference kind of where they like to answer phone calls, where they like to put out their stories. But the idea of the different levels of White House aides are all have their kind of areas of where they're accessible.
Uh-huh.
I think is remarkably similar.
Similar,
In my experience.
Yeah, I think you're very right on that. What about within an administration, during the time from the beginning to the end of an administration? Do you think there are some differences in the way that they approach the press?
I remember Jimmy Carter becoming president, remember, we've had a whole generation of presidents who were governors. I came after Richard Nixon. So I came in with Gerald Ford, who had been vice president, and then became it. But after that, you got Governor Jimmy Carter, Governor Ronald Reagan, Governor Bill Clinton, Governor George Bush of Texas. And they often came to Washington with no Washington creds, with no. So they came in and kind of managed things their own way. And the way they've all done that, I think, is somewhat similar. When they deal during difficult periods of time, they have different ways of reaching out. They'll go, for instance, President Bush right now is giving one-on-one interviews to NPR. Who else, help me, who else has he done? He's just done a whole series of these. NPR, yeah, McNeil Lair there, Report.
Right.
He did...
a lot of Neil Cavuto.
Cavuto, and then for ABC, he did our business correspondent.
He wants
credit for the good economy, so he goes and gives it. That's very rare that he does this. Another thing Bill Clinton did, Bill Clinton was getting beaten up by conservative talk radio. After Ronald Reagan's era, talk radio became a huge conservative reservoir and a very big megaphone. President Clinton was getting hammered, so he started inviting in radio talk show hosts. Maybe Rush Limbaugh wouldn't come, but he'd send somebody. And radio talk show hosts from all over the country set up tables, give them telephones, serve them coffee and donuts, and bring the cabinet out and let them just wander around and be interviewed. So the approach kind of depends on what kind of trouble the president's in at the moment.
What are some of the benefits of doing talk radio? Because they certainly do put some attention to it. Is it different in some way, the resonance of a message that you send, like a president talking to a radio host?
Yeah. There is an intimacy about radio. There's a personal something about radio, whether it's just the voice, whether you're multitasking. Who sits around and just stares at the radio? You don't. You do it when you're driving. You do it when you're in your shower, or shaving, or brushing your teeth. You listen to the radio while you're cooking dinner. Radio has a unique and I think a kind of a personal connection to people. And I've found, because every morning for ABC, I do as many as, usually four or five, as many as 20 different radio stations will call between 7 in the morning and about 11 in the morning. We have a satellite that does nothing but grab their signals and push my voice out to them when I sit at the White House with earphones on, and one after the other in my ear. And they kind of set the tone for many people. They commuters going into, we don't do it in the afternoon, it's not afternoon drive. Morning drive is when you get people heading to work, getting up, and it kind of sets the agenda, tone, and issues of the day. And of course you hear back from people who are interested about things. So I think tomorrow morning we will hear all about this woman astronaut who clearly freaked out and went and drove across the country to, is accused of attempted murder. There are little things that happen. I'm trying to think of one of the little iconic things that happened to President Bush not long ago. You know, these are things that kind of capture the imagination. We think, well, is that a story? Former President Bush says he doesn't like broccoli. Well, people talk about that for a day or two. Things happen to there was one that just happened not long ago. Shows you how my short-term memory begins to fade. But talk radio is can also, because it doesn't have the strictures of time.
Yeah.
It can take an issue like a puppy with a rag bone and shake it and play with it and chew on it and linger with it all day long. Talk radio can really juice it up.
That seems like a lot of spots you do.
It is. And it takes you away from that reporting time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm literally sitting talking to Minneapolis, and Portland is waiting to go right after that, and I've got a live shot coming up at the top of the hour, and I'm still writing my script and pulling sound bites and stuff at the same time I'm trying. I tell you, I've never been such a multitasker as when I've had to do, you know, two or three radio things at once.
Uh-huh. And then do you do television as well?
I do, and the old way of doing television, where you'd spend all day long doing interviews, reviewing the president's speech, picking out the sound bites, tailoring a script. New York would review the script. We do less and less and less of that. Mm-hmm. And more of just, you take the main sound bite that the president said. Sometimes you put what we call wallpaper with it. Generic shots of bloodshed in Baghdad, or shots of dollar bills coming off of a printing press. And then a live stand-up open, a live stand-up close. So there is less, from the White House, less of the kind of crafted and sculpted spots that we used to do.
Uh-huh. When now you prepare for your day, tell us what a day was like. And you can go back to when you your four children were in the house. Because I remember you used to do carpool.
I used to love doing most of my years with ABC covering at the White House have been on the morning side. Because Good Morning America was born right after I got there. And as the junior correspondent, my colleague Tom Gerrold and then Sam Donaldson would do the evening news spot more often, and I would do the morning spot. And sometimes I would even go up to, I did 4 years on Capitol Hill during the second Reagan term. ABC sent me up there. It was wonderful training because it really did broaden my perspective. But I would literally get up. I'd usually write my script the night before. And I'd go up, and the script would be all prepared, and I'd stand in front of the Capitol side of the, or I'd rush it. We used to be able to park on Pennsylvania Avenue outside the White House, run in, do my stand-up close for Good Morning America, go back home, we had 4 kids in 5 years, make sure they all had their school lunches, and drive, carpool, drop them, and then get back into the White House in time for the 9:45 briefing.
Uh-huh.
It was great. It is not conducive to reading a lot of newspapers in the morning, but it does give you a little bit of and also allegedly you get out a little bit earlier. And when my kids were little, I liked to be home, have dinner with them, even if we had to push it till 6:30, 7 o'clock.
You have known several presidents. What kinds of relationships do you find that you had with them, and what difference does it make to know a president well, like you know President Bush well?
To be a reporter that covers nothing but the White House makes us kind of the front line trenches troops. I am ABC's eyes, ears, and institutional memory. And I know that when Jimmy Carter walked out of the cabinet room after cabinet meeting, and the subject had been energy, and he was pushing for something and maybe not got it, I could tell by the look on his face, or the look on his press secretary Jody Powell's face, what had gone down. Sometimes when you look at people day in, day out, all the time, they tend to be fairly transparent. George Herbert Walker Bush, former President Bush, was pretty easy to read. When he was up about something, when he was convinced, especially at a time of war, when he had gotten a good field report, when something was happening, you could tell by the, you know, how his shoulders squared, the lilt of the chin. Ronald Reagan was a little harder to read, but why? People forget that he was elected. He was a two-term president. He was elected in 1980 with a huge landslide that also brought Republicans in to control the Senate. Mm-hmm. And 2 months after he was inaugurated, he was shot and almost killed. 2 months. Mm-hmm. Suddenly he became an invalid. He was in the hospital. A wall of extra physical security came down. A wall of extra political security came down. So our chance to know and get to know Ronald Reagan through the first year was greatly diminished. Like other three presidents, he came as an outsider. He didn't come in knowing Ann Compton and knowing Sam Donaldson, except by reputation. They learned pretty quick. Reagan was always a little more aloof, a little less less able to read and a little less approachable because his staff kept him. They didn't want him answering things off the cuff. I thought it was refreshing a president who would say what he meant off the cuff. Yeah. We didn't get enough of Ronald Reagan. The ones that we knew, the presidents we knew the best were the ones who said, who felt the press were part of the presidency. They are part of the job of getting your message out. Gerald Ford knew the press, was not hostile to the press, knew that part of his job after Watergate and after Richard Nixon was gone had to be to get a little fresh air into there, and he can do that through the press. Jimmy Carter made press conferences every 2 weeks. He said, I'm going to make it part of my job, not in the East Room at 8 o'clock at night in prime time, 4 o'clock in the old executive office building, part of my regular routine. That lasted till his budget director got in trouble. This President Bush does something I don't think gets much credit. You often see the president sitting in chairs like Martha and I are sitting in with a White House fireplace behind him, whether it's a foreign visitor, whether it was the new defense secretary this week, whether it was the new leader of the Congress. This president will often take two or three questions from the press right there in the Oval Office. So important. To be able to hear from the president contemporaneously on the issues of the day. Yesterday I walked in there, cabinet meeting. We asked questions with his entire cabinet arrayed about the resolutions in Iraq, about Maliki government, the kind of things we need. And I give George W. Bush credit for doing that more than his predecessors. It's a very important bit of access.
Mm-hmm. You can actually go back and see some of the balance of how they respond to reporters' questions, the choices they make. Say from Woodrow Wilson's time up through up to Eisenhower, you had off-the-record press conferences, which most presidents had fairly frequently. But with Eisenhower, it goes on the record, and it also goes on television. And becomes a high-wire act. Yeah. And so presidents gradually start shifting around, looking for other ways to deal with reporters.
You raise a wonderful point, and I have preached this for years, never successfully. A president, and a presidential candidate for that matter, has to use more than just a podium and a public speech to get his message across. News conferences, town hall meetings with voters, one-on-ones with influential columnists. Presidents, on occasion, I have been invited into the Oval Office or into the Roosevelt Room or, if we're on a foreign trip, into the president's parlor, wherever he is, for no cameras, usually on the record, on Air Force One, president comes back and talks to us, where you really can talk about an issue without doing exactly great image, a higher wire act with all the cameras and lights on you, where every word out of your mouth. One of the most fascinating hours I spent with George Walker Bush, this George Bush, we're coming back from London, and a particularly difficult round of European summits, because he's never been terribly popular in Europe. He's been regarded as a cowboy and a sharpshooter ever since he was elected. And we sat down in the conference room of Air Force One, and he sits at the table at the end, and I'm a little hard of hearing, so I get the seat right next to him, and we talk to him about the Eastern Europe and the Western European countries he'd been to, the leaders he'd been to. For 40 minutes, he was a different person, Martha. He had a nuanced interpretation of the leaders. He had skilled, informed, historical perspective on each of the countries, on the dynamics of the, it was a big NATO summit, and where the United States fit in this. We're finishing with Kosovo. We were looking at the, Iraq wasn't a problem quite yet. And it was almost a tour de force foreign policy, Council on Foreign Relations, a monologue he did. And we came out of there and said, you know, if the American people saw that, they'd have a whole different picture of this president. But when he's in public, that's not the public George Bush you see. They need to they need to communicate in all those different formats.
Do you think there are other presidents were somewhat similar that way, that they were at ease, like say his father was at ease with reporters in a setting, like whether they came in for lunch or something like that?
To some extent. I think I found former President Bush a little more even keel, a little more consistent in his dealings with the press, whether it was a small press conference. He did a lot of the small, you know, just a group of us standing there, as opposed to the big East Room.
Because he'd come into the briefing room a lot.
He would pop in unannounced. I remember I was at my children's school chapel program on a Friday morning at 8:45, and cell phones don't work down there. And as I emerged, discovered that the president was going to be in the briefing room in 10 minutes. They don't give us much time. But I found former President Bush more consistent, whether he was answering questions at the podium, whether he was doing it in a small group, or whether he was giving a speech. I think his demeanor and his tone, the amount of information he would share would be about the same. Reagan more in that camp. President Clinton would download in private, download a whole lot more than he would say in public, a whole lot more.
Did he talk a lot about policy? Have you found, like, the kinds of things in an off-the-record setting that a president would talk about would be similar? Their interests would be similar with what they were publicly?
But what I'm going for when I've got a president off the record is I know what his policies are out there. Presidents are out there every day telling you what their policies are. I want to know what he sees and thinks of what he sees. What did he think sitting across from President Mitterrand at that NATO summit? What did he think when he sat across from the Chinese premier at a very tense meeting? What did he think when he saw the parliamentarians in Poland or Hungary stand and applaud for something? I want to know what the president learned from that. I know what his policy is. Mm-hmm. I want more of what helps shape that policy.
Do you think that when a president has an off-the-record discussion like that, it can stay off the record?
No. And that is a great... you want Ann Compton's 3 points on off-the-record? On the record is pretty easy. President says something, any politician, any public figure, any source in the White House, you say something on the record, I can go on the air tonight and say, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley says that the resolution on Iraq won't pass. On background means a senior administration official, and when Kissinger's around, they used to say a senior administration official with a heavy German accent would say that. It means you can use the information. You can even identify where in the government it came from or outside of government it came from. You just don't want to quote that person. And most of that, the White House also often gives us backgrounders. Why? Because they want the president's voice to be the quote, the spokesperson. They want the president's words to live, but they want the aide to fill in the blanks. Then comes deep background, which is Ann Compton just happens to know that this resolution isn't going to pass or that the president doesn't want something to happen. Now, the president told me that, but I can't say the president. So deep background means that I'm just so smart. I just know that because I'm just such a great reporter. Off the record means that you tell me the president is going to go to South America, which he is, but that's so far off the record. And it's true. I mean, he's going to go to South America in a month, but it's off the record. But I'm going to break that policy. I know the president's going to go to off. I cannot tell anybody that. I cannot hint around at it. I cannot use it in any way, although it does kind of shape what I know about the world. So I know not to make any other plans the first 2 weeks of March. I think the president of the United States, every time a word comes out of his mouth in front of reporters, there's no way that will ever remain off the record forever. And I'll give you one example. President Clinton was impeached by the House of Representatives and faced trial in the United States Senate for obstruction of justice for the Whitewater, Monica Lewinsky, the whole mess. And the Senate did not vote to convict him, which meant he could stay in office. And we went down to Guatemala for a Central American summit just days later. And the president decided he didn't want to sit around with a bunch of Central American leaders for dinner. So he invited six of us to come out to dinner. They closed off a little Guatemalan restaurant. It was me and the New York Times, the USA Today, CBS, Fox News reporter, me, and maybe it was just five of us, Press Secretary Joe Lockhart, and President's personal advisor, Bruce Lindsay. And we sat upstairs in this Guatemalan restaurant and talked for 2 hours. And at one point, the New York Times reporter, President Clinton was saying something about, the impeachment. And the New York Times reporter, this is all off the record, we are not ever to breathe a word of this outside of the room. The New York Times reporter said, but Mr. President, you will always go down in history as an impeached president. And Bill Clinton turned around and said, President Clinton said, and I wear it as a badge of honor because I survived. And our jaws all hit the table. Here's a guy who wasn't sorry. He was non-repentant. And he was a survivor. None of us at the table could use that. Now, I did, on the way back to the hotel, I shared it with my colleague, Britt Hume, who was not invited to the dinner, because he and I shared it, made it clear it was off the record, and with my bureau chief back in Washington, as I know the other reporters did it well. You do not sit on something like that. The next day on the Fox's Beltway Boys, one of the pundits sitting there, who was nowhere near Guatemala, said it on the air. Where they got it, I do not know. Jim Engel of Fox News said it wasn't from him because he went on vacation the next day. Things like that come out. Now, how did CBS end up using it? Bill Plant told anchor Dan Rather, who soon had an interview with Bill Clinton, and asked him if he wore impeachment as a badge of shame. Turned it around. Uh-huh. Didn't say badge of honor. Is impeachment a badge of shame? And Bill Clinton said, it's not, because I survived. So he gave the quote. Yeah. So there are ways to get it. I just don't think anything stays off the record. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah, I remember he had a dinner with a group of correspondents in, I think it was in Austin, in a Tex-Mex place. And he was talking about, it was after that, about Hillary Clinton and how much money she would make if she didn't run for the Senate. Uh-huh. And I forget how much it was, like $20 million in 5 years. And so that story got reported. It was reported by Ken Bazinet of the New York Daily News, who was not at the dinner.
And who knows how
that's right, yeah. And in his case, it was more than one person told him.
Yeah. Jimmy Carter, on his last Saturday night before he left office, he had been defeated. Ronald Reagan was moving in, and ABC asked me to go down, and he was shopping for office space in Plains, Georgia. And as it turned out, his brother, Billy Carter, invited my husband and me and our little boy. We took my little baby down there with us, invited us over for dinner. So I went to dinner with Billy Carter. All the rest of the president went with President Carter, who said that he wished Menachem Begin something like three things, you know, peace in the Middle East, and he wished him 4 years of Sam Donaldson, which is what Jimmy Carter had. Well, it was at an off-the-record dinner, but that got out pretty fast. Yeah. I got to tell you, that got reported pretty fast.
Yeah, and I noticed that Bush has done a series of occasional lunches with war critics, and where he's been trying to learn more about their views of the Iraq war and what some of the alternatives are, and that it takes very little time for the information from those off-the-record sessions to hit the media.
And you know why I think that doesn't bother the president? He wants people to think that he is listening to voices who do not agree with him. Uh-huh. And I think that's one of those leaks that doesn't bother George Bush at all.
They seem to have been doing more of that in the second term than in the first.
When presidents get in trouble, when you're down, you have to do more outreach. When you're riding high, it's all coming to you. You don't have to push back as hard. But when you're in an unpopular war, when you have your own party beginning, when you get down to about 33% in the opinion polls, the job approval rate, then you're beginning to scrape your party base. And President Bush in some polls, not in ours, some are down below 30, below 33, right. down to 30. And that's where it's digging out your own supporters who are saying, come on. Mm-hmm. So you do have to work harder at it, and that's why he is.
Mm-hmm. What do you think that that a president can expect, not just what he wishes, but put that in too, from his communications operation? He sets up a communications operation. What is it really going to buy him?
Well, that's a good question. I think presidents probably always hope a good communications operation that reaches out to the opinion leaders. This is the columnists and the the hosts of the weekend talk shows and stuff, buys you good positive, or at least enough positive voices out there to get your message across. It'll get you a couple of more positive columns in the Wall Street Journal editorial page. It'll get maybe some buzz out there in the conservative talk radio. The communications staffs, though, that I've covered, I think their main function is to plan how this administration should make its point. And by that I mean, this president, after State of the Union address this year, every president after the State of the Union has a couple of key hours, and you get out of Washington, you go out to take it to Ohio and to Oklahoma and to Oregon, to places you sit with real people, saying, this is what I'm talking about. I'm not just talking to Congress, I'm talking to you. President Bush did very little of that year, this year. He had one quick stop, two quick stops, one each day, one on health and one on health care and one on the energy. And he did it with no audience in either place. There was never a public audience. He walked through a factory or a chemical plant in Delaware, and walked through, did a round table in Nebraska, or where was it, Nebraska, or Kansas, with no audience, just the press sitting there. So this is a president who I think right now feels kind of isolated. He needs a communication staff that says, okay, when they first came to office, the first week was all his
education.
Was it education? The first one was
Rob Page came in. I think his first Eastrom event
was that. And then the next was faith-based. Faith-based initiative. So a communication staff has to think, what issue do we want out there? And they're planning that 4 weeks ahead, 6 weeks ahead. Right. And that's why I think some of the more effective communications, and I think Clinton's communication shop was very good at this, thinking, what issue do we want there? How can we plan to have the president supplement all the other buzz we can get for that, much more so than how can we deal with battles right here at home? Mm-hmm. Communications, much, much more outreach there.
So, you know, presidents might think that they can change public opinion, but at least they hope they can. But that seems to be something that's very difficult to do.
Presidents can indeed change public opinions with these big televised addresses. With the president on January 10th did his big speech on Iraq, did it in prime time, did it in a way, did it from the White House, but not in the, actually from the warmth and coziness of the
library.
In the downstairs in the residence, as opposed to the scarier, more formal Oval Office. Usually, a president, when he sits down, he looks the American people in the eye and he said, this is what I'm doing, this is why it's important, and this is why I need your support. Usually presidents get a bump, almost always get a big bump. Not on January 11th, he didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was almost no, he had let it go too far. State of the Union very often give a lift. This year it did not give him a lift. So you can, a president can lift that. But basically, it's got to be because the policy, people are saying, okay, I'll buy that policy. Mm-hmm. I'll buy that policy for that matter. And right now, President Bush is in a place where he's not being able to sell it. And that's why he's finally abandoned the come with me argument. Instead, he's saying, this is where I'm going, and they can pass any resolution on Capitol Hill they want, but I've made up my mind. Give it time to work.
Yeah. In domestic policy, it's difficult to adopt that same kind of a viewpoint. And I think we saw a rare, kind of a rare thing where the president went on the road for several weeks selling personal retirement accounts mm-hmm. as part of Social Security. And at the end of it, there were fewer people that supported it than at the beginning of it.
But remember what happened during that. One of the panels on Social Security, roundtables they called, where you'd sit down with people, you'd talk to people who really say, yeah, I'd put my Social Security money here. This is how what I do on retirement. One of them came the day as Hurricane Katrina was coming ashore. We'd been with the president. It was late August. We'd been for summer vacation. We were with the president down in Crawford, Texas. And my husband had come down. We have good friends down there. And we were watching the video on the Weather Channel of this thing coming ashore. It took up the entire Gulf of Mexico. And my husband said, there's no way you're going to California, New Mexico tomorrow to talk about Social Security. Look at that. He's got to go back to Washington and manage this. No, we went to New Mexico for a round table right. and then to California for a right. World War II commemoration. And he's out of pocket he still can deal. We all know a president can deal with a crisis when he's anywhere in the world. But it took him away from the sense of being mm-hmm. hands-on. And something like Katrina just kind of pounded the nails into the coffin for that Social Security issue. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also I think it it gave a different view of him as a leader, that people thought when you looked at in the re-election campaign, when he would give his speech, where he would say, you may not agree with me, but you know who I am, and you know what I think, and what my brand of leadership is. That was always the part of his speech that seemed to be most popular, have the most resonance at the many places. And so you could find that people may have disagreed with him on policy, but they thought that he was a guy who was on top of his job, and that Katrina seemed to put that in jeopardy.
And the erosion in the president's job approval ratings in the long suits that served him so well at the beginning. Who would you trust in a crisis? Who's a decent person, who has the honor and integrity, and who has true leadership qualities. All of those so now degraded by the Iraq experience mm-hmm. that's why that doesn't work for him.
Uh-huh. I think it also is probably pretty hard, too, for a president to be around for a few years and still be seen in those kinds of ways, because you have to do a lot of political dealing.
Why does anybody want a second term? Ronald Reagan walked right into the buzzsaw. He had a war going in Central America. The Iran-Contra situation, for those of you who are obviously too young to remember any of that, it was pro-democracy. There were these bad guys, these leftists, there were these dictators who had their hands around the throats of the Central American people, and all Ronald Reagan wanted to do was give them liberty and get some, let the insurgents bring in elected government, and to get that there, if you dealt hostages, arms for hostages, and money, and get to the end, and then you lie about it, it blows up in your face. Bill Clinton, the second week of his second term, in comes a government shutdown. The government shutdown with a budget conflict. I guess it was the end of his first year, and during that time, his staff was gone, and the interns were in charge. Mm-hmm. And one intern in particular made it all the way to the Oval Office, and it was the ugliest time I've ever covered at the White House, Martha. I hated to go to work every day. The only time in the 30 years that I hated to go to work every day. It was an ugly, distasteful story.
I remember too. That seemed to be a shared view. That I can't remember.
Oh, the public thought the media loved it. The public, there are people who said, oh, you just love devouring the president, don't you? I said, no, I don't like anything about the story. Mm-hmm. It's disgusting. It's personal. It's betraying the faith in somebody you want to admire, the president of the United States, the presidency of the United States. Mm-hmm. It degrades it. And I found it really an ugly, ugly period.
Uh-huh. I wanted to ask you before I go to our audience, I wanted to ask you about a question that you asked at the press conference in Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And you asked the question about Mary Cheney. and you put it in an arresting way. And how did you come up with the way you did it? And tell us about it.
I was so frustrated at the press conference because the good questions always get asked by the wires up front and all those guys in the front row. And I did want to... the ABC person, actually, who was sitting up there, hadn't been called on. But when you past, Martha Raddatz, my colleague, was away.
She was Jake Tapper.
It was Jake Tapper, who's not a White House regular. Yeah. And I was sitting in the second row. And you really, I think, after you beat the Iraq horse for a while, unless you've got, there's a really important wrinkle there, you begin to lose angles in which you can go by to really get any information.
Right.
And my whole point of asking any question, I want to hear something from the president that we haven't heard every day. And so many of his answers, especially on Iraq, were by rote. Same thing. So I'm sitting there thinking, and I've got a couple of ideas buzzing around my head. And sitting next to me is Peter Baker of the Washington Post. Now, the day before the press conference, Peter Baker had been given one of these nice little private interviews with the president. Mm-hmm. And he had made some real news on Iraq and stuff. And as before the press conference started, I said, well, Peter, what did you, you know, what other good answers did you get you didn't publish? He said, well, we know we published everything. But he said, I had one good question I never got to. I wanted to ask about Mary Cheney, who is a wonderful young woman and who has tried to stay under the radar. She has been a very unique person in the administration and it had just come out, the news, that she's pregnant. And she's in a relationship for 15 years with a woman to whom Mary Cheney has told us, I'm married to Heather. I consider this a marriage. So I said, so you never got that question in. And so I'm sitting here today, and all these other questions, I said, well, maybe I'll give it a shot. Cheney'd mm-hmm. been asked, uh-huh. but the president hadn't. Now, we're what, 4 days before Christmas. I don't know how it came out, what went from here to here, but my opening of my question to the president was, Mary's having a baby. And I did it because it was Christmas. Mm-hmm. The president knew exactly where I was going. There was not a flicker in his eye. Uh-huh. And I asked the question. I said, actually, the president had been asked about this, but it was by People magazine, and it was in print. It was never on camera. And, of course, we broadcasters want to have everything on audio and on video. And I said, you've said she'll be a good mother, but there are, I forget exactly how I said, there are laws, mm-hmm. you know, that she will not have the mm-hmm. same equal. And the president gave an interesting answer. He said, she'll make a very loving parent, and that I have always said, I support a review of the laws to see if there are places we should change the laws so that those mm-hmm. couples can have more equitable rights. He didn't put uh-huh. it quite that way. I thought that was an interesting way.
Uh-huh.
But I got to tell you, I've never gotten so many emails in my my BlackBerry, my email. People are saying, "Great question." I will tell you a funny story. There's a wonderful market in Kennebunkport, Maine, where we all shop when we covered, and a wonderful couple now runs it. H&B Provisions, Helen and Bonnie, and they have a couple of kids. And the first email I got was from Helen and Bonnie saying, you go, girl, and that wasn't a good enough answer, and you keep asking until we get a better answer. Uh-huh. So it got a lot of attention. Uh-huh. But when I said, Mary's having a baby, mm-hmm. it was a play on the Christmas theme, but I didn't fool the president one bit.
Uh-huh. Well, let's now go to Towson and see if we have some questions there. Mike, do you want to call on students? He's the professor we have in the classroom. Oh, no. Temporary network failure. Well, okay. Let's try here. You all have some questions?
Oh, come on. There's got to be a Sam Donaldson in here somewhere.
I'd just like to say, I'm from the Bay Area. I'm a student here, but I listen to Ron Owens in the morning.
Start over again so everyone can hear you.
I'm a student here at the University of California, but I'm from the Bay Area, and I'll listen to the Ron Owens program when I'm back at home, and I like to listen to you when you...
That's one of the stations I often talk to, and he's a wonderful anchor.
Yeah, and I think you really provide, you know, a good balance a viewpoint.
Do you like to hear more than just a 20 seconds or 30 seconds from people? It's nice to be able to talk about an issue
because we'll hear you
a little bit longer.
We'll hear you at the beginning of the news, you know, at the, when they do the ABC national news. But I mean, just have some dialogue, and Ron will ask questions. I mean, so it's
this
very insightful.
This happens right at 9 o'clock in the morning, right after the 9 o'clock news in the morning. So I hope a lot of people are driving to work and driving to school and listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Sure, right here. Let's get you a microphone. Hi.
Thank you for coming, of course. First question, you had mentioned that sometimes public appearances of the president don't succeed in raising his public opinion or whatever subject matter that he's addressing. What is it that the press corps and the media can do between public appearances so that the bell curve continues to rise?
There's nothing I can do to make the president's opinion polls rise, and that isn't my job. What I can do and should do, and what I think my main focus every single day is to, whatever the president's doing, what he's saying, to be the conveyor belt to get that to people, not only tell them what he's saying, but how that fits with what he said yesterday, how it fits with what his senior aides are telling me, how it fits with what the historical, you know, stand of a president has been on things. So more and more information. What I fear happens, and what happens to a president who may feel a little pinned down right now, is that he sticks with his core argument. You don't see him wandering off of that. So basically, every day we've talked to him about Iraq for the past, even just conservative, 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. President Bush has never strayed off of his basic argument that this is what I'm doing and this is why I'm doing it, and I just ask people to have patience. And he never strays from that. I want the president to tell us more. So while my purpose isn't to have him to affect people's opinion of what he's doing, I do want people to have more and more information about why he's thinking the way he is and why he's acting. More importantly, why he's acting the way he is. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Another question?
I mean, I've got another one regarding...
Oh, please do. Sure. Talk right into that mic as if you're American Idol. It picks it up really well.
White House Correspondents Association. You're the vice president as it stands right now. Can you tell us a little bit more about what goes on in that association?
Well, I'm glad you asked about that, because a lot of people don't really know anything about it. And is it true, Martha, that the White House Correspondents Association, a voluntary, anybody who covers the White House can pay $35 and join, and you don't have to belong to it. And we do throw a big dinner every spring where we host the president, we toast him, and we have Stephen Colbert come in and make fun of him. And that's one thing that the White House Correspondents Association does. The other thing that we do, we help the White House deal with coverage issues at the White House. For instance, when the president travels around, we fly in a separate jet. We usually land ahead of Air Force One so our cameras can get on the ground and get into position. Well, recently the planes that the White House charters for us, and we pay for, the government doesn't pay for them, we charter, have been really, really expensive. We work with the White House to try to find air carriers and air providers who will have smaller, more efficient planes, especially on little short trips. We help the White House right now deal with, they are renovating our press room. Now, they're doing it not because they love us and want to give us fresh seats and fresh paint on the wall. They're doing it because the space was so old and decrepit and was not wired for, you know, the high-tech world we're in now. And frankly, probably had asbestos up in the ceiling and wanted to get it out. So We are helping them. Mm-hmm. They have the architects. They have the people who will do the work, and we advise them on how the seating should be arranged, what would work for us in terms of, now that we're in the 21st century, having electrical outlets at every seat so that we can plug in our computers, having internet connections at every seat so we can be online during a briefing or during a an event, so that we can take notes and begin to file. We've tried to help on policy when the president is considering doing. He's going to South America in a month. They take a couple of reporters on the advance trip with the people who go through the logistics. Where will the president sleep? Where will he stand at a at a press conference? A couple of reporters go along to say, hey, you know, this is a lovely spot, but if you do this at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll be squinting right into the sun and nobody will be able to see the president, or it'll be too hot out here, it'll be too noisy over here. So we try to give the president our professional advice so that the coverage not only works for us, but so that it is done with a maximum efficiency and clarity and most cost effective. Mm-hmm. And we give a hell of a party every spring.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it seems that that party is a difficult aspect of the president's. The incoming or the president's job for the Correspondents Association, getting the talent and doing all the
arrangements. This year's dinner is not mine. It's the outgoing president's, and he has hired Rich Little to come in and be the entertainer. Now, I want to know how many people sitting in that classroom have ever heard of Rich Little. None of them. Mm-hmm. He was strictly a comic for Fran for our era, right? The Nixon era, the Ford era. But Rich Little is a very talented mimic and impersonator. And I think a whole new audience is going to see him. It has gotten so much publicity in advance that the weekend of the White House dinner, I am told that Rich Little is going to be on Hardball on Friday night, Larry King Live on Monday night, and do the dinner in between on Saturday. I hope he has fresh material for us.
Yeah. Well, one of the things in those dinners is that presidents their speeches have become important too, and they have been such good comics that
very tough
at the end of the Clinton administration when he did the video.
Yeah.
He did a very, very funny video.
Yeah. About what it would be like when Hillary Hillary goes off and runs
for the Senate.
Then it had him washing the limousine. What is he going to do with his spare time? Washing the limo?
Running after her with
her lunch.
Yeah.
President Bush in the last two ones, there's a wonderful presidential joke writer, a guy who's strictly a civilian, presidential advisor for many, many years, Landon Parvin, who writes a lot of the material. But the president, in the last two appearances that he has done before the White House dinner, has said, has kind of begged out of doing a humorous speech himself, in part because after September 11th, things weren't so funny.
Yeah.
After the war in Iraq began, he wanted a tribute to the troops, but he didn't want to. He poked a little bit of fun, but it wasn't a ha-ha-ha night. So then he had Laura Bush come and push him out of the way, and she did a hilarious routine. And then after that, he had his stunt double, a comic that they had heard of, Landon Parvin had heard of, and a recruiter got him, Steve Bridges, who, I got to tell you, came in right past me with very thick makeup on, an incredible dead ringer for the president, and has all the gestures. And the president actually practiced with him. Mm-hmm. And they brought I was sitting right next to the this empty space in the table. I don't know why it wasn't anybody. They took the table out and brought in a second presidential podium so they could, the two mirror presidents could. So President Bush has been a good sport. Most presidents have been. You wonder why, if you feel you're beaten up by the press all the time, that you would even bother do something you hate, get into a tuxedo and go sit for 3 hours with a bunch of people who would like nothing more than to eat you alive and be nice.
Uh-huh.
Why would they do it?
Well, comes with the job.
It comes with the job.
Because presidents need the press as much as the press needs the president, because that's central. Communicating with their audiences around the country with the public is essential for anything that he's going to do for his job, and they sure know it, and so they're willing to suck it up and take the criticism. Towson, you're back on again. Questions there? Do we have an audio from there? Yeah. Any questions? Okay, let's go ahead.
One. Got one more here.
We hear so much about liberal bias in the media. What about Fox News? From your opinion, is it, does it trend to the right? And if so, what's this feud now, sometimes not going with one of your colleagues, but from NBC, David Gregory, another White House correspondent? I mean, there does seem to be this attack on Mr. Gregory from, Fox. So, I mean, do you feel they are conservative? And if so, why is there this feud with Mr. Gregory?
I will tell you my personal view, depending on how my viewing goes. When I'm sitting at the White House during the day and working, I keep CNN on because they do more breaking news. When I turn through Fox, I tend to see more people sitting, talking heads, pundits, kind of yammering, and I don't really want to hear that. But CNN tends to do more breaking news, so I keep that on kind of in the background. When I'm at home at night and my husband and I are having dinner, we do try to watch the 6 p.m. Brit Hume-anchored Fox newscast, which I think people do consider more, whether it's more to the right, whether it's more conservative, whether it's more pro-Bush, and I'll tell you what it comes down to. They do longer stories. A spot on ABC Evening News would be a minute 20, a minute 40. They will do 2 or 3 minutes, and they will go through a lot more of President Bush's arguments, or on Capitol Hill when they were doing one last night or the night before on the Iraq resolutions. They went into far more detail of what it was the Republicans wanted to vote on, as opposed to just what the Democratic or the anti-surge led. And they just seem to go into more detail. So some people will consider that more conservative. After being asked this for 30 years, and I promise you, for 30 years, people have said to me in sessions like this, why is it the liberal Eastern establishment elite media? And my answer is this. When we bring you news, information about which you know nothing, we come and tell you about a tornado or an earthquake or a political revolution or a mayor in the city who's self-imploding with some scandal. When we bring you news about which you have no preconceived ideas, our credibility is very, very high, and people believe us, and people believe we're very straight and narrow. When we begin to talk to you about issues of which you have very well-formed opinions of your own, abortion, same-sex marriage, budget deficits, the war in Iraq, when we begin to talk about that, the audience very naturally listen to that with their own perspective and say, well, I don't agree with you, or I don't agree with the president on that, or you're giving too much to this side or too much to that side. And when you do get into those more emotional and certainly more subjective issues, that's when the media is suddenly judged as, well, wait, that's not middle of the road. I think if every person watching took a yellow pad, legal pad, and a pencil, and watched Monday through Friday, pick any network you want, Monday through Friday, pick any network, and on each night, just write down the list of the stories done. Iraq vote, Iraq bombing, budget announcement, and put a check mark by the ones that were kind of, mainstream, that were okay. And you'd get to the end of the week, you'd have a page full of check marks. When you actually watch those stories, I think you find out almost all of them were fair presentations of the issue. I have watched even some stories on ABC where I think a reporter, and I'm not going to give you all the details, but an environmental reporter on our network did a story. It wasn't global warming, but it was something having to do with environmental, global Kyoto-type stuff. And the whole tone of the spot was, George Bush is an imbecile, and why do they ever even let him play with this issue? Nothing he does is right on it. And I got to tell you, I was a little surprised. How could an editor, a producer in New York, not at least temper some of the language so that some of the stuff does get on? Some of the stuff pro-Bush, some of the stuff anti-Bush, pro-con, it does happen, and there can be no excuse for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Towson, are you hooked in?
Can you hear us now?
Yes. Yeah.
Hi. Wisconsin, my name is Jason. I want to know on September 11th, was the White House, and when the White House was evacuated, how did ABC News, how did you get any information about what was going on? Did you contact the cycle?
Wait, you're not coming across very clearly, but we got it. September 11th, and what assignment did you have? Where were you, and how did you cover?
I love can we do one more question? Because you mind if we save that for the end?
Okay.
Because would you give me permission to do that as my very last answer? Because it's a rather involved tale. It's a good way to end this.
Maybe.
Okay.
One other question, and then we'll get to that.
Okay. Another question? And then
in Iraq, and the captures of my journalists, and then killing journalists and forces, and then push us like this, saying no negotiating.
We can't hear you. We can't understand. Can't understand it. It's coming.
Okay, in Iraq, and what's happening with reporters, and then capturing them.
Can you try getting closer to a microphone? Try another microphone.
He's talking about in Iraq and the capturing of journalists and how.
Okay. And how they're being like tortured and beheaded, and George Bush has like this thing about not negotiating with terrorists. Has that affected? Like reporters not really like stalls Judge Bush or make it something like that.
Is it hard for journalists, especially in like wartime right now, to deal with capturing and seeing journalists that are captured and tortured and beheaded? And is that something that you worry about, even though you're only in the White House?
It's something that haunts me. 1 year ago, my colleague and dear friend Bob Woodruff was injured riding in a Humvee when an explosive went off. He wasn't wearing a helmet. He was actually taping his report at the time. The atrocity of anyone, much less a journalist, being kidnapped and held in extremis and then killed is just beyond my belief. In particular, that one, the French woman who had devoted her life to living in Iraq and doing what she could for the Iraqi people. My colleague at the White House, Martha Raddatz, is in Iraq tonight. She will be there all week. It's her 12th trip there. It does worry me, and I think one of the sad parts about this war, not the initial assault into Baghdad, but what has happened to Iraq, is that many of our colleagues in covering Iraq can't go out of the green zone. We send our Iraqi local producers and our the local translators who work for us to go check out a bombing here because it simply isn't safe for anyone, much less Americans on the street. War and combat are very, very difficult things to cover, and they require an enormous amount of bravery, but also a lot of smarts by the people who are doing it. I have never been in a war zone such as that. I have been in a couple of places with the president where we were concerned about either an attack or a violence of some sort. There is no story I can think of that is worth squandering or carelessly putting yourself in a moment of grave danger just for the bravado of having that story. And I think it's a very sad chapter in Iraq right now. Too many journalists are in peril.
Yeah. Can you tell us about, say the last question, tell us about September 11th.
September 11th, my job, again, is to travel with the president wherever he goes. And on September 10th, we went with the president to Florida for a couple of the most boring education speeches I had ever heard in my life. Same issue the president had talked about over and over and over again. David Sanger of the New York Times and I had dinner together when we got to the hotel the night of September 10th, and he said, "Why are we here? This is not a story." And I said, "David, you always travel with the president just in case." The next morning, it is my day to be the pool reporter. Now, there are 40 of us on the trip, 50 of us on the trip. We can't all be at the president's elbow every moment. It was my day to be the broadcast pool reporter with the group of, there was a broadcaster, a newspaper reporter, a magazine reporter, one television crew, one from each of the wire services. And we stood in the back of a classroom as the president was talking to some second graders. And I was dumbfounded when the president's chief of staff came over and whispered to the president, "Nobody interrupts a president, even in front of a classroom of second graders." I took my notebook and I wrote down 9:07 a.m. Andy whispers, Andy Card whispers to the president. What we didn't know, while one of the wire services had been told there had been a plane crash in New York, and we figured that's what the president was being informed about. I was thinking, you know, why in the world do they let those little sightseeing planes fly around New York anyway? It ought to be banned. I went over to the side of the room where Andy Card was now standing, and with my hand, I made the sign of an airplane, and Andy nodded and put up two fingers. Two plane crashes. One is an accident. Two is trouble. What the president months later told us he heard with chilling economy of words in his ear was, a second plane has hit the World Trade Center. America is under attack. For 30 years, I'd covered the White House knowing that there is a doomsday scenario that unfolds at the time of nuclear attack, a time of war, a time when a president is threatened. The Secret Service's job is not to protect George Walker Bush, but to protect the presidency, the line of succession, the American democracy. And immediately, you saw that come into play. Ari Fleischer, the press secretary, came out to us and said, when we came out of the classroom, said, there's been this two plane crashes. The president wants to make a statement here in the parking lot. I said, Ari, we have live cameras in the school cafeteria. They're online, ready to carry his education speech back to what? Please have him go there. We can get him live on the air. We went in there. We knew very little. We had not seen the planes crashing, but my office quickly on my cell phone told me what basically had happened. At that moment, a protective shield comes around the president, and the president made a brief statement saying, there's an apparent terrorist attack. I must return to Washington. We will find those who are responsible and bring them to justice. We were raced aboard Air Force One, which was primed and ready to go. In fact, they had taken the stairs away. The president went up through a little small shaft staircase to get on more board more quickly. Our gear was gone through, the Secret Service looking through our gear. We run on board, the plane door slams, we start to take off. We don't know that since he said that he was going back to Washington, the Pentagon's been hit. In my experience, If the attack that was once just the heart of New York, the financial center of America's financial heart, was hit, was one thing. But when there's an attack in Washington, the heart, this is now against the U.S. government, there's no way the president's plane would ever go back into Washington. In fact, we circled for hours. One of the crew members told us, my job is to gather up everything that's happened and report back to all of my colleagues who are still on the ground in Florida. How? Airplane, we aren't allowed to use our cell phones on board. We know very little. We were told periodically the president's on the phone to Vice President Cheney. He's on the phone to the Situation Room. He's on the phone to the mayor of New York. The camera crew was allowed to get a few pictures of him on the telephone. When we landed, basically to refuel, I was given a telephone. It was a military telephone. And they dialed through to ABC. I'm now the pool reporter. And I knew that not only the facts that I would give to ABC, who would then distribute them to all the other networks and presumably the rest of the press as well, the tone of my voice, the degree of specificity I could do, all of that would set the tone, had to reflect what was going on with the president. It was very controlled. It was very limited in what I knew, but I had to be very thorough. After I dictated to ABC News television desk all of what had happened, what we'd been told, the president was now on the ground in Louisiana, he was on the phone, I was piped into on the air with Peter Jennings. And Peter Jennings was, of course, live. I realized later that this is the way most of the press got my pool reports. I was live on the air, and they were sitting in Florida with no facilities, and they could at least listen to what I would then tell everybody. And I told Peter that the president was, you know, what he was doing, and he was talking to Washington. But we were also told that the president was going to keep traveling. All of a sudden, the people around me, I'm live on the air with Peter Jennings, get up and start running. We're leaving. And on the air, I said, Peter, I've got to go. We're leaving. And he asks a very reasonable question for an anchorman. Ann, where are you going? And I said, Peter, I have no idea. Honest answer, not exactly the most encouraging or comforting thing. You know what happened that day. The president eventually stopped in the Strategic Air Command headquarters. I was there given more telephones. I phoned in more pool reports. We had been told earlier not to use our cell phones. They didn't want the president's location identified. But every time I had a bit of information I could pass along, I would call the ABC television desk. But we knew very little. So you all knew much more than we did. So finally, Ari Fleischer comes to us, says we're going back to Washington. That's on the record. You can tell your office as we get back on the airplane. And we're flying back to Washington, and we've made one last phone call to tell the networks that President Bush now believes it's safe enough to come back to Washington. He'll address the American people from the Oval Office. We land in Washington, and again, I get on the phone, and I do the report. He's getting on the helicopter. For the first time ever, they not only had the helicopter for the president, they had a separate helicopter just for the two reporters who'd been allowed to travel on with him, Associated Press reporter and me. And we flew in this beautiful golden afternoon up the Potomac River to land on the lawn of the Washington National Monument. And we flew right between the Pentagon with a tower of smoke still coming out of it and the White House. You forget how small Washington is, how close together they are, how that plane could have been aimed at anything there. And on this beautiful, tranquil day, we land, the president safely inside, getting ready to speak from the Oval Office. I go inside. My pool responsibilities as a reporter were over. And I walk into the ABC office where my colleague Terry Moran is already working, and I open up my, I see on the television the picture of Barbara, the political pundit, who Ted Olson's wife,
Barbara Olson.
Who I had no idea she had been on one of the planes. I had no idea that any of the people on the planes had been able to call their loved ones or call the authorities, say what was going on the plane. And then I open up my laptop. I'm the mother of four kids your age. I had, at that moment, had three in college and one in high school. And I open up my laptop, and the first email waiting for me was for my son at Vanderbilt University. He said, Mom, my fraternity brother, Ted Adderley, was on the 93rd floor of the first tower. Well, I knew enough to know that that was a moment of instant impact. All of a sudden, the day that, as for a reporter, I had been running on kind of professional instinct and adrenaline and reporting what I knew and doing it as a matter-of-fact way I could, all of a sudden it had a human face. And it was the college friend of my son's. And the whole day that had been crashing steel and doomsday scenarios and military protectivists, all of it came down to the face of a handsome young man who was killed instantly. And that impact hit me, and I sat down and I cried. And I think all of us as reporters continue to have that sense of vulnerability and that sense of responsibility that when we do bring people word of what the president's doing and how is it doing, how precious that chain of information is and what a responsibility and what a privilege it is to be at the White House every single day bringing that news and bringing that responsibility, covering the American presidency. Thank you for asking.
And thank you very much, Ann.
Thanks,
Mark. We enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
Thank you all.
Thanks.